Welcome to Pop Culture Happy Hour, NPR's roundtable podcast about what we're watching, reading, and listening to. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. This week, we'll binge on the new Gilmore Girls episodes. We'll talk about the new Disney film, Moana. And as always, we'll close the show with what's making us happy this week. So stick around.
Take Pop Culture Happy Hour and more with you on the NPR One app. NPR One finds you the best from public radio and beyond. National and local stories, many of which have nothing to do with the election, and your favorite podcasts. NPR One is ready to make the holidays, waiting in line, or waiting for a friend better. Find NPR One on your app store.
Before we get started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around an expanded table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books, comics, and other stuff for the NPR website.
Our first special guest this week is Daisy Rosario. Daisy, what do you do?
I'm the creative director of a new streaming app called 60DB.
Oh, wow. And also with us is Margaret Willison. Margaret, what do you do?
For money, I am a librarian, and for mostly love, I run a newsletter called Two Bossy Dames. I have a podcast called Appointment Television, and I throw what has been termed by me the best 24/7 slumber party on Twitter.
That is right. Well, the reason why we have Daisy and Margaret both with us this week, let me explain a little bit about how this show will work. We're going to talk about Gilmore Girls first, and Stephen is going to sit out because he somehow wasn't up for catching up on 7 seasons.
I have never seen Gilmore Girls.
Stars Hollow history. So he's going to sit out. And then in our second segment, we're going to talk about Moana, and I'm going to sit out. We'll explain that when we get to it. So Stephen, off with you.
You can't actually see me skulking out of the studio with my head hanging down, but that's what's happening.
That's right. Get out. Get out.
All right.
You're not welcome.
Away with you.
And as you hear us talk about this, you'll probably wonder, if I didn't watch Gilmore Girls, like Stephen, will this mean anything to me? I think the answer is no. I think the answer is it's not going to mean a whole lot to you. It's going to be like going to someone else's family reunion. You might have a good time. You might enjoy being around the people, but none of what's going on is going to mean a whole lot to you. So that would be my thought about that. So Gilmore Girls. Since it went off the air in 2007, Gilmore Girls has remained a staple for folks catching up on DVD or on Netflix. And as it's done with some other shows, Netflix has produced a revival, in this case consisting of 4 movies that make up a series traveling under the name Gilmore Girls, A Year in the Life. Many of your favorite and less favorite characters are back. The fast-talking dialogue is back. And perhaps most significantly, show creator Amy Sherman-Palladino, who was not around for the 7th and final season, is back to wrap it up the way she's always planned. If you're a listener to Pop Culture Happy Hour, you might remember that Daisy actually was with me for a small batch earlier this year talking about the fact that this was coming back. Daisy, how did these 4 movies strike you?
Oh, man. I really, really enjoyed it. I really did. I felt like it was wrapping me up in that warm Stars Hollow blanket.
Yep.
But I mean, I definitely felt like there were things that I could see how they might annoy people. But yeah. For the type of show that Gilmore Girls is, I felt like it really worked because it's not The Wire. It's not an overly serious show. Even things that they did that definitely feel, you know, like lip service to fans and things like that still, to me, fit into the world of what Gilmore Girls is and the kind of show that it is.
Yeah, so you were happy to be back kind of in the world of the show.
Yes, definitely. And I mean, I definitely liked some of the episodes more than others, mm-hmm. but the arc as a whole of, you know, 4 episodes, they work together.
Yeah. How about you, Margaret? What'd you think?
Well, I have a grid of faces
yes.
that I took of myself making, and I did the math, and annoyed faces outnumber cry faces 2-1.
Okay.
But I think the cry faces mean more. So
yeah.
What I mean is a lot of it really bugged me. But in terms of the things that were meant to be big emotional payoffs, they were big emotional payoffs. And I think the feeling I got from those is going to last longer than the eye rolling.
Yeah.
Maybe.
I think that's a fair response. How about you, Glenn? Where's your balance come out?
Oh, you know, I was just glad to be back, just like Daisy. I mean, we talked about pop culture serotonin before. This is not that. This is comfort food. This is pop culture comfort food. This is the familiar rhythms. And I mean that literally because I am here in this show for the dialogue and mm-hmm. for the characters. Characters who tend to revolve around Rory Gilmore.
Yeah.
mm-hmm. As opposed to Rory Gilmore herself. I mean, I'm there for Michelle. I'm there for Paris. I'm even there for Kirk because Amy Sherman-Palladino knows that those characters work best in small doses. So we get lots and lots of small doses. And yeah. here, Liza Wheel as Paris had a great scenery chewing bit in a bathroom where she does the thing we want her to do, where she yeah. implodes yeah. Amusingly.
What is this? What am I feeling?
I don't know. What are you feeling?
I'm feeling fear and loneliness and heartache. Listen to me. I sound like a freaking Blake Shelton song.
Kelly Bishop gets a lot to do. Both Kelly Bishop and Liza Wheel are...
And Kelly Bishop plays Emily Gilmore, who's Lorelai's mother. Lorelai exactly. is played by Lauren Graham.
And both of those elements are key to this show because without it, you got nothing but twee.
Yeah.
And you yep. need that acid. You need that sharp bit because ultimately we find out something that's been the kind of undercurrent of the entire series. There are moments in this show when the show feels like it needs to not just tell us that Rory is fantastic, but show us. But they don't. They never manage quite to do that. They assert it. They have everybody around her assert it. You get the feeling that the show has bought into this doctrine of Rory Gilmore exceptionalism. We get to see her flailing. Yeah. We get to see her not be perfect, and that's also necessary. It's annoying. It felt like it was advancing something that the show itself had never really established that well.
Yeah. This is one of the places where I felt the passage of time mm-hmm. was that I think Rory's personality, which was always kind of confused wanderer a little bit, kind of precocious, confused wanderer, mm-hmm. worked in one way when she was 16 and works really differently when she's in her early 30s. You yes. get that yeah. feeling of like, okay, but I mean, I don't think it's too spoilery to say when you find Rory, she's essentially given up her apartment. She's sort of saying, well, I'm just going to be a wanderer. And you realize that what she means is I'm just going to be a deadbeat mm-hmm. and yeah. stay with I just assume I can stay with various people for free indefinitely. And that's going to be my version of wandering. And I don't think the show ever really comes to terms with what that would actually look like in a person in their early 30s, that the presumptuousness of just assuming that you can indefinitely stay for free with a series of friends and family while you think about your life would actually right. be perhaps unappealing at Rory's age.
It know. Sure didn't appeal to me much.
Yeah. yeah.
But I did feel like there was some reality to it in the sense that, you know, we're supposed to be seeing her in this not great year of her life, and she's in a rut, and ruts don't usually start with people being that well aware of them.
No, that's
and
true.
So it's other people saying to Rory, like, you're just going to do what?
Yeah.
And she has not understood yet what the decision she's making really is.
Right.
And it takes her a while. And so in that sense, I believed that.
I feel like at various points in this, you talked about time passing, Linda, and it felt like a little number of years had passed, but in terms of emotional maturity and discussions, things were very frozen. Mm-hmm. The problems that the characters are having at the beginning of this series, specifically the problems Rory is having in her life independent of Emily and Lorelai, and the problems Lorelai is having in her life independent of Rory and Emily, are problems that they would have had 2 years after the end of the original series,
sure.
not 10. And if you look at Rory's behavior and you're like, oh, a 24-year-old might do that, mm-hmm. it does make sense. But as a 32-year-old, my God, Rory Gilmore.
Oh, yeah, man. I feel personally judged now. I had a rough early 30s. Like,
you will encounter with me the narcissism of small differences with Rory because we're the exact same age. We graduated from college at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like I watched the finale of Gilmore Girls in my college dorm with, you know, 8 of my best friends 3 weeks before I left the 1 square mile where everyone I loved best in the world was right. always accessible.
Right.
You know, my life is very directly parallel to Rory's, which means I am unbelievably judgmental of what she's doing with herself.
That's a fair point.
I also feel the same way about my relationship to Rory, but I feel the opposite. Like my mother and I kind of will joke about how, you know, she's my Lorelai because I did get her to watch it. And my mother texted me while watching the show and went, they should just change Rory's name to Daisy.
Well, you know, I think the mark of a round character, at least one mark of a round character as opposed to a flat character, is that you can anticipate how they'd react in any given situation. Not that they're predictable, but that you know them well enough to develop a sense of them. And I don't have a sense of Rory Gilmore alone on the show. I don't have a sense of who she is, what she would do, and I don't think the show knows. That's why we're constantly getting bombarded with people telling us how wonderful she is, because she reads a lot.
Yeah, well, and because she wrote this one piece.
Oh, my God.
There's this piece that she wrote for Talk of the Town and The New Yorker. It appears to be something that has suddenly made her a wildly in-demand writer for everyone, to the point where she's just taking meetings from this one thing that she wrote months ago, and it's kind of like we could spend the entire segment on this and shouldn't, but if you think freelance writing life is gonna go the way it goes for Rory Gilmore, which is basically you write a couple things and then everyone starts courting you, that is not how it works. And I will say the other place where I felt the passage of time was that I don't know whether television's employment of certain kinds of stereotypes has lessened since 2000 to 2007, or if I've just noticed it more. But I will say, I think in contrast to this little quirky town where most of the people are white, who you bump into, there is some employment of, you know, I think other than Lane, Kim, the stereotypes of kind of Lane's family and the kind of Korean-American people on the show are kind of stale. There's a bit about Emily's housekeeper that really comes down to, like, Emily's housekeeper is a foreigner, and isn't that funny? And it was weird to me. That was the other place where I felt like, boy, I feel like if you premiered this show now, this is something people would comment on quite a bit if it were this prevalent.
Yeah, there were some moments of that throughout.
Yeah.
I liked Emily's storyline with Berta, her housekeeper, in terms of like what it's teaching you about how Emily has changed.
Right, yes.
But that's kind of a crummy way to be using characters of color in white people's story nowadays.
Right, exactly.
Like if the only role this person is there to play is to show you how a white character has changed because she hasn't been fired yet. Ooh, yikes. Yeah. And I mean, I think you do get like good translation jokes with her.
Yeah.
Just like her commentary. There's a scene where she's talking about Emily cooking soup for herself.
Right. Yes.
And you get a bit more of a sense of her as a character, but that didn't sit perfectly with me. And there were a couple of other jokes that were also just like dumb. Like there's a long bit about a gay pride parade in Stars Hollow that's like trying to lampshade the fact that there were no openly gay characters on Gilmore Girls when it was running.
Right.
That's not great.
Yeah.
There's a big fat joke that you're just like, why is this on here?
Ever.
Yeah.
Like, what is this for?
Well, and I was going to say, I think whenever they try to broaden out a little bit and actually dive too far into other characters, you realize that the creators of this show are not really invested in anybody else. They're invested in Lorelai and Rory and Emily now that Lorelai's father, like the actor who played him, has passed away.
Ugh.
The places where I felt like it was strongest are in those relationships between Emily and Lorelai and Lorelai and Rory, and everything else is underserved, I think, to some degree. Do you agree, Glenn?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it was great to see all these characters return, but I think the format is doing things to the structure in a weird way. That's why we get the entirety of Stars Hollow, the musical.
Oh, boy.
Which just
Stars
keeps
Hollow.
Going.
Stars,
10
Stars
minutes.
Going.
It's almost 10 minutes long, and it's a musical within.
Yeah.
Sort of have to see it. It did
not
work for me.
It's a joke that works if we see a couple snippets of songs.
Yeah.
But Waiting for Guffman knew that we can't see the entire freaking song. The Sutton Foster song at the end of that worked very well, did exactly what it needed to do. And speaking of musical things that go on way too long, the return of the Life and Death Brigade, whom I had completely forgotten about because they had spotless minded themselves out of my brain. Oh, my God.
Oh, like, my God.
I was just beginning to come around on Logan, like, oh, he's not such a terrible person. And that moment's like, oh, it all comes rushing back to you, that this extended sequence where they march in time to a cover of Get By With a Little Help From My Friends, you understand, A, you are looking inside Amy Sherman Palladino's mind. That's what it looks like in there. Everybody has stupid hats.
and too much money, and somehow it's adorable.
I don't understand that. Nobody was clamoring
Aren't
for them.
Aren't rich people cute and charming?
There were so many people like talking about how much they love that online, and I was just
really?
What? Were they?
Yes. And like, if anything besides traffic made me crazy this weekend, it was that. But I have to say, as much as I hated that sequence, if it reminded you of why you're not supposed to like Logan, then maybe it's winning me back a little bit.
There are a couple things where stuff goes on and I don't feel like the show has an idea of how it reads outside the room. So one of them is that extended sequence. The other one is the series long runner about a boyfriend Rory keeps forgetting to break up with.
Yeah.
Which they seem to be presenting as like, isn't this adorable? Like, aren't the Gilmores wacky? And I'm like, no, the Gilmores are selfish monsters and Emily is always right.
Yeah.
Margaret, I think that's one of the points of the show. That's what I was talking about. Yeah. With it, some kind of growth where anytime we can see the town around them reacting to them as when they are using child labor at the at the pool or the way they act at the pool or this idea that Rory considers herself different from all the other 30-somethings who've come back to town, that becomes a running gag and it is also showing her in a negative light, not a positive light.
So you think it's self-aware when they do that?
I do think it's self-aware.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I didn't feel like it was meant to be adorable at all. I think part of what their dynamic is that Lorelai and Rory live in this bubble. They live in this bubble of their relationship. And as many characters throughout the original series and even in this, when we do see Christopher, acknowledge, like, nope, there's just something about the two of you together that doesn't let the rest of the world in.
Yeah.
And so to me, that was one of those examples of like, no, look, like as much as we can try to enjoy different parts of Rory, like she's being a jerk right now.
Right.
You know?
And I want to go back to Daisy for a second, because this is something Daisy and I talked about earlier in the year when we talked about this revival. Where did you come down on the treatment of Rory's various boyfriends in this series?
First of all, I was shocked that we had to deal with so much Logan. If there was one thing I certainly didn't want, it was that there would be so much Logan.
Lots of Logan.
I think a lot of people assumed going into it that it might end up being the situation of which of Rory's exes will she end up with. And the fact that that wasn't a focus, actually, even though they hint at a few things here and there, was great. Because I did not want to see that. I mean, I thought that they, for the most part, kind of justified some of it, with the exception I hate Logan so much that it's just hard.
So much.
It's
just more
it's just
Logan
hard.
Than you wanted.
Yeah, but you know, like the way Jess shows up is somewhat organic in that yes, he is Luke's nephew. He shows up in scenes where he's supposed to be meeting Luke for something to deal with the mother and the uncle that we, you know, the mother and the father-in-law that we don't actually see this time.
Right.
But, you know, it's not like he just wanders in and goes, I just felt like stopping by Stars Hollow, which is what I thought might be some of it.
Right.
I'm glad that for the brief moment that we see, oh goodness, why am I blanking
Dean.
On Dean? Thank you. I'm glad that for the brief moment that we see Dean, it's like
Dean.
In the setting of Dean. It's like in Dosies and then it's over.
Yeah.
So some of those moments I thought were nice, but oh my goodness, like why so much Logan? Like,
yeah.
Ugh.
I've historically been an anti-Jess person because as a high schooler, that whole thing of like, I read, you know, like
I read sullenly.
I read sullenly, exactly. Really kind of is very off-putting to me. I liked the way that he had, I kind of like what he's grown into. I kind of liked his sort of laid back.
He certainly has grown.
Glenn liked the, Glenn noticed the arms.
Oh, yes.
Yes.
Hard to miss.
Yeah.
Accented by a really big, chunky piece of jewelry. Did you notice that?
I
he
didn't.
Had this weird, stupid
I didn't
ring.
Notice the jewelry. I was distracted by the fact that he's still carrying a duffel bag around.
Yeah, there is that.
That's true. I think there was somebody, when Glenn mentioned the arms, I think somebody mentioned to you on Twitter, somebody said it's just he's just developed those arms from carrying his duffel bag on his endless journey. There's some truth to that, I think. There's some truth to that. But on balance, I really did like it. And I still think there's enormous power in those scenes between Emily and Lorelai in particular.
Mm-hmm.
Those in many ways are my favorite. They spend some time in therapy together. And I thought those were funny. I thought the therapist was funny. The therapist is one of the many people in this series who I knew from Bunheads.
Right.
Many Bunheads cameos for Bunheads likers among you. Amy Sherman-Palladino's other show, sadly short-lived. I liked the therapy scenes. I thought in the end it was effective. And the business that deals with grief is, I think, ultimately effective.
Yeah. Gilmore Girls has never been a show that was about the plot.
Yeah.
It was always about the relationships and the way that they interact. And I always loved the dynamic of Emily and Lorelai, even when it frustrated me. You know, in the original series, there was something so true about it. A mother and a daughter who are both different and yet wildly similar in ways that they don't understand, and the way that those two things will always come up to play against each other at various points, I thought felt really true and is the heart of it. And so, when I say that some of those other things didn't bother me as much, it's because to me, those relationships were intact, and that is the core of what that show is.
Right. I agree. And I'm glad that we were able to come and circle back with Daisy and have Margaret with us. And I'm glad that Stephen didn't have to watch 7 seasons of Gilmore Girls. Come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH. Tell us what you thought about this revival. Open your own dialogue about Rory's disappointing boyfriends, the movie musical. Mm. Now, our second topic this week is the Disney film Moana. And as it happens, one of the credited writers on Moana is Pam Ribbon, who some of you might remember as Pammy, who was a recapper at Television Without Pity at the same time I was. And because Pam and I are still friendly, and I actually chatted with her a few times while she was working on this project, I thought that I would sit back from this conversation. That's why Stephen is back here in the room, and I am going to take my stuff and go. That's the other reason we've got an extra deep bench this week. So hang on. I am going to get myself out of this room.
All right. Thank you, Linda. Okay, so the latest in a long, long line of animated Disney feature films opened last week. Moana stars Auli'i Cravalho as a girl who's been groomed to replace her father as the leader of a Polynesian tribe, but she, like basically every Disney heroine ever, aspires to more. She wants to adventure beyond the island, see the world, and she ultimately gets her wish when she is chosen by the ocean to embark on a quest to return a stolen relic to a goddess named Te Fiti. And along the way, of course, she has to find Maui, the immortal demigod who stole the relic in the first place, and he is played with great bluster by Dwayne "The Rock" Johnson. Margaret H. Willison, I'm going to start with you. What did you think of Moana?
I really loved it. It's definitely working with a lot of archetypes, sometimes in ways that aren't perfect. But in terms of how it moves forward with the Disney formula, there was so much I was excited about. In terms of the base enjoyment of the Disney formula, it really works for me. And I thought the songs were exactly as catchy as I wanted them to be.
Yeah, now just briefly, the songs we should note were written by Lin-Manuel Miranda from Hamilton, as well as Mark Mancina, who worked on The Lion King and some other projects, with a composer named Opetaia Fowai.
Right. I was so pleased that they brought in that composer because I feel like it's a real mark of how seriously Disney was taking the project of working with another culture's stories and traditions, and that they weren't just going to throw in, like, it's great that there's this phenomenal glam rock number sung by an evil crab, but it's also wonderful that there are these songs that are based in the more specific traditions of the islands where these stories are set, and that you get that texture. I think it makes the music better. And I think it makes the art more virtuous.
Yeah, I think they made a clear effort throughout this film to be true to the story they were telling and to not, and just to not screw it up. I mean, clearly a great amount of work was done to do that. Daisy, what did you think of Moana?
I really, really enjoyed it. And it took turns to things I wasn't expecting. Margaret mentioned archetypes. So true with Disney films. You kind of have certain things that you expect to happen. And some of those things did happen, but there were also things that were completely unexpected to me. And so I really enjoyed that. And I'm, as always, glad that I did see it in a theater with kids, because it's always a good reminder of what the kids will laugh at versus what I will laugh at and why those things are there.
For me,
because
it's
when they
about
laugh
the same.
At that chicken every single time, I go, right, kids love the chicken.
Yep.
I actually thought that chicken was a clever twist, like a clever head fake, because she has an adorable piglet, mm-hmm. and then
yes.
she has this ridiculous idiot chicken. And what character do they follow? They follow the idiot chicken. I thought that was cool.
I know.
His
friendship with Moana, the pig's friendship with Moana, got written off completely.
Yeah.
He didn't get to go on the adventure.
Look, this movie's gorgeous, as you guys are saying, this, but it looked fantastic. And my husband's theory is that the reason it did so well is because it's been a punishing 2016, and it's a cold November, and you just want to look at that. These vistas, what they're doing with water is just fantastic. The songs, as you say, are solid. With, help me out here, Stephen, what is the musical thing? Am I recognizing Hamiltonian chord progressions? Is that mm-hmm. what's happening there? That is...
Well, and lyrical structure.
Right.
It is identifiably mm-hmm. Lin-Manuel Miranda writing these songs.
Exactly.
Hey, what has two thumbs and pulled up the sky? When you were waddling yay high, this guy. When the nights got cold, who stole you fire from down below? Look at him, yo. Oh, also I lassoed the sun. To stretch your days and bring you fun. Also, I harness the breeze. You're welcome to fill your sails and shake your trees.
What can I say except you're welcome?
It does feel Disney. It does feel very carefully wrought, committee-driven. You can tell this was focus group within an inch of its life. But for that reason, it doesn't, as you guys were saying, it doesn't feel like the Enchanted Tiki Room, you know, the last time Disney embraced the Polynesian by just kind of reducing entire cultures to bullet points and just throwing in some stereotypes. So it does feel familiar, but there were, as you mentioned, head fakes. We think it's going to end with one thing happening, and that thing does not happen.
Right.
Because it's 2016, right. Theoretically. Mm-hmm. And also, there is a third act, not twist, but reveal mm-hmm. that I did not see coming.
Yeah.
And that has never happened in a Disney film. That's just not what I go to a Disney film. It's like, huh. Like, that is not an expression that comes out of me in any Disney film ever before. So, yeah, I liked it a lot.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'm coming down more or less the same way you did. I sometimes, and I did this with Frozen 2, where everybody is celebrating Disney's subversion of its own BS.
Yeah.
And I never want to give them as much credit as everyone else does, because, like, they're the ones who created these tropes mm-hmm. that are now being subverted, and, like, better late than never, it's 2016.
Right.
It did a thing that a little bit like Wreck-It Ralph did, where it mm-hmm. kind of plays with the notion of, like, she's not a princess, but they make a bunch of jokes implying, like, yeah, she's kind of a princess, mm-hmm. you know, right. She's the daughter of the leader of the tribe. I come back to kind of just wishing, just make a story about a freaking girl.
Right.
instead of having to kind of comment on it
yeah.
bugged me a little bit. I had a little bit of the reaction I did to Frozen, which, if you recall, if Deep Cuts, Pop Culture Happy Hour, Glenn and I were both kind of like, man, needs more jokes. It's fine. And then, of course, no, I was doing myself as much as I was doing you. That was supposed to be a portmanteau of our voices. But you know, and then the movie became this huge phenomenon, and it meant a great deal to a great number of people. And I sort of felt, as I think you did, Glenn, like, man, I kind of missed the boat on that. And I felt like, boy, I'm walking into a little bit of the same trap with this movie, because this movie does a bunch of things in ways I really appreciate. She is a plucky Disney heroine, but, like, she's so much more kind of in control of her own fate. She's more self-directed. It doesn't go in places you think it's going to go, as Glenn alluded to. And I appreciate all that. And I'm sure that's going to mean a lot to a lot of people. Not to mention, this is a non-white Disney heroine who looks a little bit more like a human.
Right.
Figure-wise, a little more like a human, but the same exact face as every single Disney princess. Not Disney princess. They've gotten into the computer animated era, and in the computer animated era, there are posts about this where they trace the line of the jaw and they trace the line of the nose across all of the female characters in the last 10 years, and it's identical.
Yeah.
And once
you
see it,
has that grandmother
you can't unsee it. Mm-hmm. And you're like, could she just maybe have a nose that was pointy? Maybe. Could she maybe have a jaw that was square?
You're kind of touching on some of the kind of the main point, which is, as much as there are nice little subversions of Disney tropes, it is still fairly on rails as a Disney quest movie. It is still fundamentally the same story as a lot of Disney movies. Kind of plucky heroine, you know, meets up with a bullheaded, you know, cynical hero to whom she has to prove herself. Kind of like Tangled in a way, a movie that I love. But it is not necessarily like wildly inverting anything. It's just, I think, a very successful version of the Disney template.
Right.
And you can still get a sense of the double standards that you're working with if you compare sort of like what Moana's arc is like to what Simba's arc is like. Mm-hmm. Right? They're very similar positions in their stories, sort of similar non-European settings. Mm-hmm. And Simba gets to be like a brat. He, like, runs away to become a frat boy. And, like, Moana's big rebellion is, it's like, I'm not going to stay here on the island and be responsible. Yeah. I'm going to go out on the ocean and be responsible. For making
her big rebellion is something that half of her family still supports.
Yeah.
Although, I think it's worth noting, the matrilineal half of her family. Very strong matrilineal story here. Mm-hmm. Something noted and appreciated by the 11-year-old I saw the movie with.
Nice.
There's a whole interlude with some very minion-like pirates that just felt like, okay, you're looking over your shoulder. Don't look over your shoulder.
It was very Mad Max.
Yeah,
it was a little Mad Max.
I think intentionally so. I think so. And there's a Twitter joke that Why? Don't. Yeah. Don't. Don't. You're not DreamWorks. Don't be DreamWorks.
You ant.
You'd be timeless.
Yeah.
When we talk about, like, this movie's place in the Disney tradition, I do think it's important to note that the directors of this film, the main directors, Ron Clements and John Musker, also directed Aladdin and The Little Mermaid and The Princess and the Frog. Mm-hmm. They are, like, Disney lifers, and they're working with Don Hall and Chris Williams, who did Big Hero 6.
Right.
These are not people who are necessarily coming in from the outside to shake up the Disney model. It feels, as much as anything, a little bit like a fusion of, kind of the way Big Hero 6 did, it feels like a fusion of Disney and Pixar.
Mm-hmm. When it comes to the Disney aspect of it, it feeling like Disney and kind of sticking to its own thing, I mean, I feel like that's a whole much larger and very interesting conversation that could go on for hours. But I am reminded, having just taken my sister to Disney World last year, and she's 10, how much people who love Disney love it so much. Yep. And so there are times where I want them to try new things. And then I remember that would actually really disappoint those people who, you know, get married there and get tattoos of Disney and just make pilgrimages there every year. And it's a level that I definitely don't get to, but that on some level I appreciate when I'm at the park.
I think that's a good point, that like straying too wildly from the formula is not necessarily going to satisfy the audience.
Mm-hmm. Although I do think it's worth noting that there is another Disney movie that this compares interestingly too, which is Lilo and Stitch, which is a much smaller movie. But if you want a Disney movie that is just about a girl, it's about a pair of Hawaiian sisters who are struggling with the Hawaiian foster system to stay together. And like a wild alien sidekick gets injected into their lives and mayhem ensues. And in that, you have characters who are drawn, like the computer animation is beautiful, but it's very uniform. And it doesn't have the expressionistic tendencies that you see with some of the earlier hand-drawn animation that Disney did in like Sleeping Beauty or 101 Dalmatians or Lilo and Stitch. Mm-hmm. And there are some sequences where they're doing something with Polynesian folk art in how they're rendering stuff. And those are so beautiful. And it would have been really fun, I felt, to see something a little bit more like The Secret of the Kells and a little bit less like Frozen with a tan.
Frozen with a tan. All right. Well, I am sure that people listening at home have thoughts on Moana itself. Come to our Facebook page at facebook.com/PCHH. And when we come right back, we will talk about our favorite segment of this and every week, what is making us happy. So stick around.
Support for Pop Culture Happy Hour comes from LearnVest. LearnVest is an online financial advice company focused on empowering people nationwide to make smart decisions with their money. If you want to know how aggressively to pay down your student loans, LearnVest can help with that. If you want to know how much you should put aside for saving, contributing to your retirement account, yep, they're on it. They'll create a custom financial plan, plus they pair you with a financial planner to help keep you on track. To see a sample plan and get a $50 credit, go to learnvest.com/happy.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It is time for our favorite segment of this week and every week. What is making us happy this week? We've got five people on the mics this week, so we're going to go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week?
A couple of quick notes about Arrival, the movie that we talked about. One, I mentioned the score by Johan Johansson and how much I loved it, but I did not realize that my favorite piece of music in this score is actually by the composer Max Richter. And I highly recommend downloading the song On the Nature of Daylight from 2004, which is basically soundtracks the climactic scene in that film. I have been listening to that on loop over and over and over again. It is so beautiful. It is such a gorgeous piece of music. That's thing one. Also, if you have not read it, Linda Holmes wrote a beautiful, beautiful essay about Arrival that we did not mention in that discussion called What We Can Know and What We Can Change, The Optimism of Arrival. It made me cry and cry.
All right.
It's really, really, really beautiful.
All right.
Also, over the Thanksgiving break, got a chance to finally catch up on Sherlock with one full month to spare before new episodes. I'm very proud of myself. I never do that.
That's wonderful. Thank you very much, Stephen Thompson. You sound sound very happy. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week, buddy?
You know, if you were to ask me, is The Crown any good? The Netflix series, it's basically a biographical drama about the reign of Queen Elizabeth II. Is it any good? I don't know. I suspect it isn't much. I mean, there's so many scenes of somebody coughing into a handkerchief that turns out to be bloody. Lots of scenes. Lots of bloody handkerchiefs.
Classic move.
The pace is slow. It is glacial. It is tectonic. It's a very fawning look at the Windsors in a weird way. Nothing's at stake. These people are incredibly entitled. They're hemmed in by custom and propriety. It's very Downton Abbey in that way. It's very like, what happened to the pudding spoons? It's like that kind of a thing.
Yes.
For 10 episodes. Uh-huh. And the other thing is, Linda, pay me a compliment. Any compliment, doesn't matter.
You have the best arms of anyone on this podcast.
Thank you. It has changed my life because now all I ever want to do is to express gratitude with that sort of strangled, toasty way of saying things. But 5 minutes in and I was ready to foment a revolution. I was ready to pick up a musket, but it is so soothing and it is so relaxing and it looks great. They paid $100 million pounds for it, so it looks fantastic. Claire Foy is doing a good job as Queen Elizabeth. John Lithgow is basically Burgess Meredith Penguin, but still, it's just, okay. I do find myself quite taken with it.
Thank you very much, Glenn Weldon. All right, Daisy Rosario, what is making you happy this week?
So I've got a couple of shows, and here's the thing about me and television shows. I tend to have different things that occupy different spaces in my heart, right? So,
sure.
For example, How to Get Away with Murder is my, like, absurd, like, wait till my boyfriend's not home, pour a glass of wine, and, like, kind of laugh at how crazy it is while enjoying the drama. So for me, my two shows right now are Insecure on HBO,
wonderful.
Which is a great show,
so
but
good.
Also is, like, taking the place of shows over the years like Sex and the City for me, where it was, these characters are actually super flawed, even though they themselves don't realize it yet, which is very human. And we're going to watch them go through this journey. And even though there are heroes, they are anti-heroes. They are female anti-heroes, which have a different kind of fun to them than male anti-heroes.
Yep.
And then the other one, which for me now will fill the void of kind of parenthood and Gilmore Girls, if you will, is This Is Us, I am very much into. To me, that is another show that is like wrapping a blanket around myself for the most part. You know, again, I look at that show and I look at my own family and I go, you are all flawed people that I love anyway. And then on that show, I watch them kind of be both likable and not likable at moments, but dealing with the dynamics and the relationships between each other. They had their big Thanksgiving episode just before the holiday. And I found myself thinking, yes, I have to see the Thanksgiving episode specifically of this show. So I was excited about that. And I, in general, if you haven't checked it out yet, just know that I love Randall.
Oh, nice. Yeah. And that's also the rare new network drama that's sort of a hit.
Yeah.
Which is, it's kind of old fashioned, but nice to hear that it's doing well. I intend to catch up on that one myself. Thank you very much, Daisy Rosario. Margaret Willison, what is making you happy this week, Hula Hoop?
Well, fittingly, I've got something that is both a stuffy British costume drama and a drama that is about very flawed people and why you should love them anyways. And that is the 2007 series Cranford, which is available on Amazon Prime.
Mm-hmm.
Which I'm rewatching from my television podcast right now. And it is maybe a piece of perfect art, which does not mean that every single person who watches it will like it. It is a lot of bonnets.
Yes.
It is a lot of ladies bustling about.
It's a prim gossiping. It's a prim women in hats show.
Mm-hmm. It is, but it is a perfect prim women in hats show, Stephen, and you would love it. And it's actually really a fussy women in bonnets show, which is a very different thing. But also, it's really powerful to watch at this particular point in time, because the basic drama is it's like a bunch of widows in a small town in England confronting the reality that a railroad coming to town and how it's going to change their community.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a lot of people who are very hidebound and traditional, right, finding ways to be kind to one another in new circumstances and learning things that they have to change about the rituals that they've been assuming. And, you know, for reasons right now, it's kind of a hopeful thing for me to look at old, close-minded people having their minds changed and opened and finding ways to be kind in spite of tradition.
Sure.
So that's one thing. And then the other thing is Laura Mvula, has an album that she did with the Metropole Orchestra in 2014, which is actually a reworking of her sort of neo-soul pop as beautiful 1950s lush orchestral arrangements, like something you'd hear from Shirley Bassey. And it's my favorite album to listen to at this time of year because it gives you a very distinct sense of holiday without it being like wall-to-wall sleigh bells.
Right.
Like, you will not hear any Christmas classics, but you'll listen to it and you'll feel festive. Sing to the moon.
Thank you, Margaret Willison. So I'm not going to talk about the fact that it's Hallmark movie season, even though it is. Maybe we'll get to it. I haven't seen any that I want to recommend yet. But what I want to talk about this week is that I received a preview of the soundtrack of La La Land, which I have already mentioned. It is the very traditional, in many ways, movie musical with Ryan Gosling and Emma Stone that's going to open on December 9th in some places and then wider the following week. And that soundtrack is also going to come out December 9th. And it's really interesting because when you see a musical only once and then you hear, you know, there's snippets of the music in trailers and things like that. Sometimes when you get a chance to hear the soundtrack, either you'll still love it or you'll think, oh, as just music floating idly, I don't enjoy this quite as much. But the things that worked well for me in the movie still worked really well for me to just listen to. It's not the towering achievement of the Hamilton cast album or anything like that, but there are some really lovely pieces on there. And I think when people get a chance to see the movie, I'm so looking forward to talking about this movie and having more people that I know see this movie so that I can talk to and at them about it. So again, the La La Land soundtrack is coming out December 9th. You can hear an Emma Stone song that, as I mentioned on Twitter, is going to storm the barricades of your high school and college auditions and talent shows. I promise. You can hear some very lovely, kind of old-fashioned Ryan Gosling crooning. It's very cute. December 9th for the movie and the soundtrack, both La La Land, directed by Damien Chazelle, who did Whiplash. So that is what is making me happy this week. Now, before we go, I got one other thing that I want to mention. We talked about this a little on our tour. If you want to support our show, if you want to support the Politics Podcast or Code Switch or other podcasts at NPR, all of our digital projects, we would really appreciate it if you made a contribution to your local station. You can become a member and set something up regularly, or you can offer them one time. Money is also fine. And tell them that we sent you. Tell them that you listened to the podcast, because that is how you support the public radio system. I'll give you a little hint. My contribution to my local station, I belong to my local station, my regular contribution ends with and 44 cents. It's not just 44 cents. It's and 44 cents in honor of Studio 44. That's how I mark my little donation. And so if you want to mark your donation and 44 cents, then they will know that we sent you. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Steven at I Dislike Steven. You can follow Glenn at GH Weldon. You can follow Margaret at Mrs. Friday Next. And Daisy, remind me what your Twitter handle is.
That'll be RunDMR, like RunDMC.
That's right. I follow you, but I could not remember the handle off the top of my head. But now I know it is RunDMR. You can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy. And our producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, KATZIF. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in-and-out music that you are tapping your foot to right now. So thanks to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you right back here next week.
There's a new show at NPR, and it's a little different from what we've done before. It's called Radio Ambulante, and it's in Spanish, our first ever podcast in Spanish. The show takes a look at Latin America and U.S. Latino communities, bringing you stories that you might not otherwise hear. Punk rock in Cuba, stolen books in Colombia, junk bonds in Puerto Rico. Hosted by novelist Daniel Alarcón, Radio Ambulante tells Latin American stories from the inside. Check it out on the NPR One app and at npr.org/podcasts.